It's my pleasure and honor to introduce Mr. Hutter. I could tell you that he's a professor for sociology, musical sciences, and many other fields. He is currently the director of the Department for Cultural Sources of Innovation at the WZB. He's also a journalist and an expert for music, but I would like to ask questions addressed to a sociologist and an economist. Now, my first question refers to a theme I would have loved to treat in my book, yet I don't know enough about it. To what extent can you talk about debt in a global context at all? Or does debt mean the same all over the world? Or would you encounter debt all over the world? Because if you study ethnology, you learn that property means something different depending on where you are. Might mean that you own a canoe, might mean that you are allowed to sell a boat or rent it away. So property depends on cultures. And wouldn't the same apply to debt? Or is there a universal formula? Well, sure. This also applies to debt, and there is no universal standpoint. And actually, I can't talk about our civilization only. And this is interesting also with respect to the moral dimension you've talked about in the last few minutes. In modern times, we have witnessed a shift because morals and ethics become less important and different debt systems matter. In other words, there is a legal dimension. We clearly know what we may do and what we must not do. And in case we don't comply with the law, we will be punished. There are sanctions. And then there is the political dimension, which means you assume the responsibility for a deed somebody else has done, i.e., the minister accepts the moral responsibility. And then, of course, the cause is in the minds of the scholars, i.e., guilt is being substituted for it by cause or causality, which means at the end that we have a very clear, a very pure concept of what guilt means and what a debt is. And it means that it's part of a process that begins in a given moment and ends in a given moment. And people don't call it debt anymore. It's about credits, granting credits or raising credits. And the concept of guilt or debt only matters there where people are having problems already, because if people are indebted, they can't pay their debt back. So nobody goes and says he has accepted too many loans, whereas the debtor is, so to speak, a hero because he builds the future of society, has a vision and needs money. I mean, that's what we label a startup in Germany. The owner of a startup is your current credit hero. So he knows what he wants. He has a good idea Thus, he only needs someone with 2 million euros and a good engineer in order to implement his plan and in order to be rich. I.e., the debtor is who helps us move forward, and he needs the creditor in order to get going. Now, today, we talk about the national debt, whereas in the 18th century, when people started to use national loans in order to get the economy going or in order to help the economy recover, it was called a public credit. So debt is the ugly side we are talking about and people try to hide today. Now, right you are, there is a negative connotation. But there is obviously also a clear line between what you'd call a credit on the one hand or a loan and then debt, which is also about failure. And obviously, the two differ according to the purpose. Because if you are an investor, you might need a loan in order to invest. And then debt would be negative because you need money in order to keep up your standard of living. Now, I don't think that the purpose matters. It does not matter. What matters, however, is the potential of payback, i.e., will you be able to pay back? This must be real. This must be serious. You need forecasts and probability proofs according to which you will be able to pay your loan back. I mean, that's what we call a business plan today. They teach business plans or business planning at schools. And the business plan is not a guarantee for the creditor, but offers a bit of security because the creditor has done enough in order to make sure that he will get his money back. Now, if the business plan is faked, the situation is a different one. Maybe someone needs a loan in order to keep up his current level, his standard of living. But in such a situation, obviously something has gone wrong already because otherwise he would not need a credit. Now, for the creditors, it's sometimes also nice to keep people waiting because a loan is about interest payments. And the interest payments are part of the yield, are part of the profit you generate with a loan granted. So the creditor will always assess whether the debtor is still worth the credit or not. Now, what I know from my studies at the Max Planck Society is that credit card agencies don't earn a penny because of you and me, because people who pay that debt back immediately don't generate profit. It's much better to have people not pay back their dues because then you might impose penalties on them. They have to pay, and that's how the credit card agencies generate money. Like the secret societies in Nigeria in the 17th century, which invented penalty systems, which were so harsh that people had to become their own bonds physically, and then they could collect these people and bring them to the coast and send them as slaves to America. A similar system existed in the Ming Dynasty period in China when there were disasters, natural disasters, and the farmers couldn't buy seed anymore. Many urbanites became rich because the farmers had to sell their daughters who became slaves, and it was then cheap to get new slaves. So whenever there were disasters, people suffered. Yes, And of course, you can also trigger disasters in order to make sure that you remain in control. Well, I'd like to jump over to another topic, a more economic one. That is, because you talk about the melting of the core with respect to the financial crisis we are currently suffering from, and you spoke about the meltdown in order to underline the particular characteristic of the current crisis. And I would like to ask two questions with respect to this particular concept. On the one hand, has our concept and understanding of the economy changed since the last crisis? Because normally you think that the heart of the economy is the manufacturing industry and the producing economy. But obviously, in the course of the current financial crisis, people begin to see the economic concept in a different way. So obviously, the core today, the heart today, is the financial economy. I mean, of course, you need all the rest. But finance has become the core, the center. And if it gets lost, everything will be lost. So let me ask you, is my perception correct? And am I right to be to feel threatened or fear? Because the implication is that we have to protect the core by all means. Because even if the banking system doesn't work well and produces injustice and unfair treatment, we have to protect it because it's untouchable. Well, no, it's not. I was interested in the swap of metaphors. Crush was the original concept, and that's easy to visualize. You see a building crushed, and you see total destruction. And this is a tangible idea. Now, all of a sudden, it's the meltdown. And this is different because this is something which happens inside of something. It's auto-referential and affects the core, sorry, the frame or the shell. And the shell can be everything around the core, i.e. could be the reactor, could be the environment as a whole. Now, system theoreticians have long understood that the phenomenon of communication, i.e. talking about values and promises, is the vital bit. And only after promising comes action and thus construction. So we are having less of a promise today. Just imagine the loans for seed in agricultural societies in the past or modern times, which put the promise in the center. Mr. Seiler talked about the importance of the import of silver to Europe, which triggered a boom and made capital funds or assets available to those who wanted to be merchants. So this was, so to speak, the basis of trade. Now, in recent times, in economic studies, it's rather assumed that the economy is the real thing, but it's covered by a veil, which is finance. It's vague, but then you can also go and name the institutions, banks, and others. Now, those who are interested in the economy might wonder, how does it work? I mean, how do you create money? I mean, is it like commercial banks getting loans from the central bank, and on the basis of these loans, they can build a whole pyramid of further loans, which then gives you the volume of money, which is part of the economic cycle in the national economy, and which has to matter in each and every transaction. I mean, it works, and it works well, even when people abuse the system, and it's still working. So I think we know much more today about how the processes are and how the whole system works. And we know that the economy is driven by these processes. So it's not only financial players who should have a say or who should be involved as if they were real players. Now, should we support it if it crashes or collapses? Well, I'd say no, because mutual trust goes deeper than institutions, and it will always be possible to find alternative options, more transparent ones, more rooted ones, because the lack of transparency of what happens today enhances the moral hazard and irrational risks. Now, I'm not an economist, and I don't know much about it, but I have a question. Now, on the one hand, the Federal Bank controls the monetary flow, but then obviously nobody controls how many loans are being granted. Well, yeah, that's what I taught 20 years ago. The Federal Bank controls the monetary flow, or the volume, the monetary volume. But this is not true, actually. This has changed in the last 10 years, and it's not really possible to control the money supply or the money stock anymore. It's much more difficult to control it because of digital technologies and other procedures that help build up this stock much faster than it used to be. Digital tools, for example, algorithms which can be built so that they withstand divergences, and also because of increased acceleration, and also because it's much easier for the traders to get involved. I mean, in the past, there were a number of specialists, a few experts who knew each other, and they traded with each other. Today, it's different. So this is one of the aspects which make me say that it's possible to adopt more rules and to implement more regulation, but this is going to be a long process because we are dealing with conflicting interests here, and also because the power distribution at the political side is a different one. The financial sector and banks have adopted well-established positions in the political world, so it's difficult to take something away from them. Now, wouldn't it be possible to tax these newly created loans or reassembled credits? Now, taxation seems to be the easy way out, but after some time, you realize that this is just another problem the players have to avoid. I mean, that's like the light system we work with, the traffic light. I mean, no one dares to stay more than 20 minutes up here on stage because then you see the red blinking right. Now, with taxation, it's the same. And tomorrow, maybe we meet again, and then we stay 5 minutes longer. And after 1 week, we stay on and on and on. And that's what happens to taxation. Well, thank you, Mr. Hutter.